Like, are you what holding me to Kevin Hart? Are you holding me to Ice Cube? Are you holding me to LeBron James? Like, do I have to be an athlete to be black to you? I bet LeBron James hasn't seen, you know, every single black movie made in the 1990s. So, you know, like, it's always been weird because you're holding me to a standard, but you can't define everything that's encompassed by the standard.
You know, in real life, we don't go around thinking that every white woman we run into is a Karen until she proves herself wrong. So it's just like that's something that white women go around worrying about, that they have to like prove that they're not a Karen. But it's like when I am in a predominantly white space, I have to think cognitively about not coming off as a certain stereotype about black women, whether that's over-sexualized or whether that's like the loud, angry trope.
I always think about like the medical field and how black women are treated, how we're like always assumed to be exaggerating about like pain and we need medication, and like everyone assumes that we have more strength than we do have. And so I think that even in like an attempt to protect us, it'd probably be minimal, because you're already assuming that like we have certain strengths that will protect us.
Welcome back to the DEI podcast. I'm Max Gaston. My guests for today are Ayanna Murphy, president of the Notre Dame Black Law Students Association, Aisha Ba, social chair for the Black Law Students Association, and Joshua Mannery, president of the Notre Dame Student Bar Association. Earlier this season, we did a Black Men's Roundtable discussion where we talked to Black men in law school about different issues that were important to them. We wanted to follow that discussion up with a general conversation among Black law students. The topics that we'll cover include the importance of representation and what it's like to be a Black law student, how Black men and Black women relate to one another, and how we overcome stereotypes and biases around members of the Black community. Here is our Black Law Students Roundtable discussion.
Okay, Josh, Aisha, Ayanna, welcome to the DEI podcast. Obviously, I want to hear from all three of you what your perspectives are about being in law school as Black law students. And, you know, where we can probably get things going with that is the hot button issue right now for law schools, for really anyone who works in admissions, is the recent affirmative action decision that the Supreme Court came out with in the Harvard and the UNC cases, striking down affirmative action. Now, obviously, each of you speaks for yourself and not for the law school. And so taking that in mind, and maybe we can start with you, Josh, talk to me about your reactions to the Supreme Court's decision on affirmative action and how your own experiences have informed your views on representation in law school.
So my initial reaction really revolved around how I imagine prospective law students would feel, because I've been so embedded with the admissions team here the past 2 years at Notre Dame. And I know how complicated the process is for a student thinking about applying to law school, wondering what they need to put in their application materials, how to go about it, who to talk to. And there's so much anxiety out there anyway. And so when the decision came out, I just got really sad, because I know that although it's a decision that affects admissions offices more than the students, a lot of students are just going to be confused. They're going to be scared. They're going to wonder if they can talk about their real experience, or if that discussion would get them removed from the conversation. And so I'm just really nervous about the student perspective and all of this. You know, we have the luxury of already being here, so it doesn't really affect us. But I'm concerned about the impact it might have mentally on students of color throughout the country. In terms of my own experience, you know, I come from the Deep South. You know, race is an integral part of a lot of students' experiences growing up in the South. And so, you know, I couldn't imagine going back to applying to Ole Miss, applying to a lot of these undergrad institutions, and, you know, navigating the process of like how much of my experience can I really talk about, you know, being a public education product, being in a school district where 98% of students were African American. You know, like, just the complexity of navigating that situation seems tough. So again, I feel for the students who still have to apply to school, and I'm sad that it's gotten to this point, but that's just my opinion.
Hmm. Ayana, what are your thoughts?
Like Josh said, race is an integral part of everything. We're in a system that's built on racism, essentially. And so I think it was very disheartening. I hope people still apply. I've been seeing all these articles about HBCUs are preparing because they know they're going to get like an influx of applications as they think like students won't feel comfortable applying to other schools because they don't think they'll get in. And I think that's like really sad and it really makes me upset. So hate that for them.
Aisha, what are your thoughts?
I really wish the court was able to see that affirmative action, it's not just about looking at somebody's race. It's about looking at their entire experience and how that experience can help shape the career and the schools that they want to go to, because schools right now, they look a certain type of way, and we're lying if we say that, you know, certain types of people aren't already admitted based off their connections, based off who their parents are or what alums they're connected to. And so it was hard for me to see like how affirmative action can't also be acceptable in the same way that like legacy admissions are perfectly acceptable. So
something that we don't talk about that much, I don't think, is how having other people who look like you in a space can give some people a little bit more confidence to stand upright in that space and feel like they can truly be themselves. And so I'm interested in exploring what you all think about representation and if you can weave it into what your experience is like in law school.
Yeah, I'll start. I remember my 1L year, there was a 3L named Marquan. He seemed to have every type of credential you would want from a law student. You know, he was over a journal, he had the GPA, he was clerk, you know, he was checking every box that you would want from an excelling law student. And I think for me, that was really validating coming in and being able to look to people like Marquan, to students like Marquan, who not only served in these representative capacities, but also took the time to still engage with younger students, to mentor me as much as he was willing to do. And Marquan isn't the only Black student who served this role, but he was the first person I connected with because we connected before I had even made it to Notre Dame. I just think that's really important because a lot of times your biggest opponent in law school is going to be yourself. And there are going to be so many instances where you are, you know, challenging your ability to succeed, or you're telling yourself that you're doing something wrong, when in reality, you're doing what every other law school student is doing, which is struggling, because it's not a journey that happens seamlessly. And so being able to hear that reassurance from somebody else and to kind of plant that seed of excellence early on, I just can't speak enough of how invaluable it's been for me.
I would agree. It's definitely important to see people doing well and like thriving. But also, I think the thing I appreciated about the other students, the 2Ls and 3Ls who were here when I got here, that they're very open and honest, and like, I guess, seeing the vulnerability and like still seeing them be successful, still seeing them like persevere and like continue to work hard. I'm like, that's amazing, because law school sometimes can be like very crippling. And like, even like Josh was saying, like the fear that you yourself have of like not doing well or not being up to the par or whatever, like to meet the expectations and like confirming other things that you know, like maybe I don't belong here, and like imposter syndrome and all those things come into it. So seeing people who look like you, and they're like, oh yeah, no, I feel that, but like I'm here and we're gonna do well.
It's definitely helpful. Like when I was coming in, just talking to the 2Ls and the 3Ls and seeing what types of clubs and co-curriculars that they were involved in. So it meant a lot to me that there were other students who were on journals, or Black students who were on journals, and Black students who were on moot court. And, you know, this next year we have two Black students on law review. So I'm so glad that the incoming 1Ls, that's something that they're going to be able, like they have representation in those spaces, and they're going to be able to see that they can aspire to be in those similar clubs. So that's something that means a lot to me, and I'm really excited for them.
Representation is a great way to challenge certain stereotypes that individuals have. Because when you see more and more people who break your stereotype, eventually your perspective on what it means to be a Black person, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be anything starts to shift, because you're confronted with real life examples that violate the assumptions that you were making. And so I want to shift to talking about stereotypes and the stereotypes that we have for each other, maybe the stereotypes that other people have about us as Black lawyers, Black law students. You know, before the show, we had conversations around how there's an anger stereotype that is oftentimes put upon Black men and Black women. You know, the angry Black woman stereotype, or an over-sexualized Black woman. You know, the Black man who is in prison or dealing drugs, or, you know, these things that you see on TV, these narratives and these tropes lead people to have certain ideas about what it means to be a Black person. And so I'm curious what your all's thoughts are on stereotypes like that, and how you feel you overcome any labels that other people might put on you.
I was going to say, this is interesting, because I would say that the three of us probably all have been told, like, oh, you don't fit into, like, stereotypical, like, you know, the angry Black man trope, or the angry aggressive Black guy trope. And that's something that, like, we've talked about, and kind of how it's like people think that it's a compliment to tell you that you're like, oh, but you're different, or, you know, things like that. And so sometimes we kind of, I don't know, it's hard to navigate the space when you're, like, unclear as to how people view you. And for me, most people probably are like, oh, she's very, like, meek and mild and, like, very to herself. I'm an introvert, so naturally I'm just trying to always avoid the nonsense. And I'm like, yeah, okay, like, I may want to be part of that. And so I really don't give you enough energy for me to think of the angry Black woman. One of the things we've discussed is kind of how we think, unintentionally maybe, we also feed into these narratives amongst each other, across each other. And, like, sometimes we respond, like, something won't happen. Like, for example, you see someone at home and they'll think, you're like, oh, they're like an angry person. You're like, you know, and, like, just you think it, but you don't realize, like, the power of naturally calling someone Black aggressive or angry or something because they don't interact with you.
Part of it is internalized. And because you grow up around these stereotypes, and even though you know that they're racist, or, you know, they're microaggressions, you know that, you know, cerebrally, they still take hold of you at times. So even when I'm, like, maybe really passionate about a subject in class, and or someone says something that I don't necessarily agree with, like, I kind of have that moment where I'm like, oh, I could say this, but then I'm like, I don't want to come off as, like, an angry Black woman. So it's like you definitely wrestle with those thoughts and emotions when you're in the law school environment, because you have really tough conversations in class sometimes, and not everyone in that room has the same perspective as you. So that's something you have to grapple with, like, dealing with maybe insensitive comments or uncultured opinions, and internally wrestling then with, okay, well, I don't want to come off this way because that's the stereotype against me. And you kind of have to be slick and navigate your way into expressing yourself in a way that makes you feel comfortable. So I definitely still deal with internalized stereotypes like that all the time.
Josh, I want to get your perspective on this question about how we challenge and overcome stereotypes. But to add a little bit more context before you speak on that, you know, when we talked about this before, I kind of characterized you as the poster child of the soft boy era in the law school. And for people who don't know, the soft boy era is this sort of trendy perspective that talks about young men who are challenging conventional masculine stereotypes. It's kind of the sort of response to toxic masculinity, guys who can stand in more sensitive energy, softer, kinder energy, and still be recognized and seen as a complete man and not have one thing undermine the other. Tell me about your view about how you overcome stereotypes about what it means to be a Black man.
Yeah, I hadn't heard the soft boy label until we talked about it the first time, but it definitely doesn't bother me. And I can't argue that it's not true. And I think for a long time, I've always kind of fallen outside of the stereotypical masculine traits. You know, I've gravitated towards women in terms of building, you know, friends and everything. I wasn't in a fraternity. I didn't play a sport past high school. I did a lot of extracurriculars that were more female or women dominated, like student government orientation, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, what I try to push out now is, you know, own the things that you do and be proud of it, because that's how you take care of yourself. That's how you express yourself. So I went to a Big Time Rush concert because I enjoy Big Time Rush. I wanted to go to a concert and I had the ability to go. I had a field day at the Beyonce concert because she deserved to be, you know, respected and appreciated. Men can suck sometimes, but women will keep it real a lot of the time. And I don't think anything I just said should be construed as a negative. And as long as you're not the one construing it as a negative, then, you know, what can everybody else do?
You know, in real life, we don't go around thinking that every white woman we run into is a Karen until she proves herself wrong. So it's just like that's something that white women go around worrying about, that they have to like prove that they're not a Karen. But it's like when I am in a predominantly white space, I have to think cognitively about not coming off as a certain stereotype about Black women, whether that's over-sexualized or whether that's like the loud, angry trope. So it's just like for the Black women that do conform to those stereotypes, like it shouldn't really change how we look at the broader community. It shouldn't, I don't know, it shouldn't become our individual problems. I don't think that it affects me when a Black woman is loud and angry, because probably she has the right to be so for some good. I'm sure she has a damn good reason to be like that. So, yeah, I just try to not make it my problem. I don't know.
I'll hop in and discuss, I think, the internal community perspective to what Max posed, which is the idea that we take each other's Black cards, or we invalidate somebody because they don't live to stereotypes that we're not even the ones who created, but you know, we're helping to perpetuate by holding somebody to that standard. At least on a Black heart perspective, you know, taking somebody's racial identity away from them, it's always been interesting, because like who is the optimal Black person that you're looking towards? Because everybody has their baggage, and everybody can't check every box. It's like, are you holding me to Kevin Hart? Are you holding me to Ice Cube? Are you holding me to LeBron James? Like, do I have to be an athlete to be Black to you? I bet LeBron James hasn't seen, you know, every single Black movie made in the 1990s. So, you know, like, it's always been weird, because you're holding me to a standard, but you can't define everything that's encompassed by the standard. So that's one thing I've never really aimed to do. And I think, so, you know, we make it very easy to try to do it. You know, we make it a colorism thing. We invalidate, you know, multiracial people's, you know, one half of their identity. Oh, they are Black with the white. They're half Black, half white. You know, were they in a sorority? You know, were they all Black, but were they in a sorority, a predominantly white sorority? You know, did they play, you know, a less mainstream sport? You know, and it's just so easy to do that. But I think that's very isolating. I think that's damaging. And so that's like the one thing I don't do. Now, Max knows this. I like to take people's Southern cards, you know, coming from the Deep South. That's something I like to joke around with. But I would never like go up to somebody and say, have you not seen Abbott Elementary? Give me your Black card. It just doesn't make any sense.
And just commenting on that, I would say that's one thing I really appreciate about the Black Law Student Association here. If you're like Black identifying, you're Black, period. Like, and I love that, because I'm unclear as to when the whole, like, if you're mixed, you have a white grandparent or relative, that being you're Black thing happened. So I'm always caught off guard when like that's like a point for like, oh, we're taking away your Blackness, or like, oh, if you have whiter skin, we're taking away, like, I'm just always confused. I feel like if that's your experience, if that's who you are, that's who you are. And so I would agree with Josh. I think a lot of times we say things in jest, But it doesn't always come up that way. So, like, for example, like, I think me and Aisha, we have, like, a girl's game night, right? And I was, like, teaching them how to play spades. I'm like, how do you black women know how to play spades? Like, all black people know how to play spades. And, like, honestly, I was saying, like, jokingly, but, like, I would hope that, like, when they hear that, they're not like, oh, my God, it's like, she's, you know, taking away from our blackness. And so, like, just kind of being mindful of the thing, I guess, I have to be more aware of it. Because I think a lot of the time we say things jokingly, but it doesn't come up that way.
To my defense, spades is very hard to learn, you know, and I did not think that my blackness was being diluted in any manner. It was just, I was really embarrassed. I was ashamed because how did I get to the age of 23 and I've just never played spades? Like, I've never tried, but it's truthfully such a hard game to learn. So I don't fault any black person out there, if you're listening, for not knowing spades.
I think if you wanted to make the argument for two things that, you know, you might argue every black person should have in their repertoire, I would say spades and the electric slide. But again, that's in jest to Ayana's point, and it's not a requirement. I just think, you know, you too, you know, cut the video on.
I mean, I have very Southern, like, I was very from my very Southern grandparents, and, like, we were playing spades at, like, 3. So to me, I'm like, what do you mean? You can't, like, what? The kids all know how to play this.
But I think what y'all are saying, and I think it's something that I tend to agree with, there's a delineation that needs to be made between identity and culture, right? Because undeniably, there is a black culture that is familiar with all of the things that you're talking about, in addition to a whole host of other things. And we've watched that culture transform with the dawning of new media, where you've got black Twitter, black Instagram. You know, people talk about things in the cultural zeitgeist, and a lot of culturally relevant things that are associated with black creators and black community members, that exists. But if you're not a part of every piece of that, or you're not a part of any of that, it doesn't mean that you're not a black person, right? We can't invalidate your DNA because you haven't subscribed to certain cultural norms that the majority in a country or in a region have subscribed to. And I think that that's really the thing, right? Because if we were to go, say, drop any of us in, I don't know, the UK, in South Africa, in Germany, we can probably find black communities that have some of the cultural norms of black people in the United States and North America, but then they probably have other things about that culture that are so foreign to us because we're not from there. And they could just as easily say, you've never heard about such and such, black card revoked. Do you know what I mean? So the culture aspect of it is severable from the identity piece of it. And I think that that's something that we sometimes forget about. The other thing, and this might be just kind of a fun thing to go around and talk about, Josh, at one point you mentioned Kevin Hart, and it just got me thinking about not exactly microaggressions, but when people come up to you and they tell you who you look like. I've gotten the "you look like Kevin Hart" before, which I think is crazy. Have y'all gotten the "who do you look like," and who have they said to you?
They lie to you, Max.
They did. That was pure
racism.
I've
never looked at you and saw Kevin Hart in my life.
Period.
I get Steph Curry. It used to be Michael Ealy a lot because of my eyes and me being light-skinned. I know I am not as handsome as Michael Ealy. Don't have to make the faces or anything. I get it. But now it's Steph Curry. Now it's Steph
Curry. That's not what...
No, that's fine. I say I look like Michael Ealy. Everybody makes
it. The face was for Steph Curry, I promise.
My face was for Steph Curry.
That was Steph Curry's shock because I thought he was
not at all. Like, not even a little bit. I even like,
you nutty.
Ayana, who do you get?
I don't get anyone. People don't tell me things like that. Like, I get things that like, oh, so you have such beautiful brown skin and a car of car. Because, okay, thanks. That's where I think it goes.
What about you, Aisha?
Let's not even get into objectifying the actual skin color that people will do. Like, yeah, that's just always so strange to me. But people will always say that, and this is partially because I used to talk a lot so I could see it. They would say, like, Nicki Minaj, because I was really obsessed with her.
Why do I know that's who you're going to say? Oh my God, that's crazy.
I was really obsessed with her when I was younger. And so I welcomed it when I was younger, but of course I got older and, you know, things changed. So I don't know if that's as true anymore, but
Something else that I want to talk about, and I think we've touched on it a little bit, is the relationship between Black men and Black women. A part of this is currently in cultural conversations where we talk about the need for men and women in the Black community to support one another, and maybe certain things that are prevailing ideas about how we treat one another that can be alienating. So what perspective do y'all have about relationships between men and women in the Black community? And what do you think those relationships mean in your personal life, in your circles with you and your friends?
So for me, I think that I don't want to say indoctrinated, but I feel like it's kind of beaten into me to like protect Black men. Like that kind of like, that's your job. Like no matter what's going on, don't call the police on them, don't report them, like none of these things. And so I feel like it's really hard if you see something happening and you feel like, you're like, oh, that's not good. Like something should be done. At the same time, you don't want to feed a system of already incarcerating Black men and massive rape. And so for me, I think like, I had a really hard time with just being like, I feel like I want to be protected. I feel like I don't want you to experience the hatred from me that you're already experiencing from the other people in the world. But I also think it's a terrible thing to teach your daughter. Like, I think a horrible thing. I think that feeds into like domestic violence and abuse and like all kinds of other things of people staying silent because you don't want people to get in trouble. And you've been taught that, like, you don't want to feed the system. So, I don't know. I think I have a lot of mixed emotions on how we interact as a people.
And with that, too, I think we also, as Black women, tend to take on the emotions Black men. So whenever they're going through, kind of in that same vein, we feel a need to protect, like, almost protection by like assuming whatever they're going through. And I think that's such a unique thing because it's not always reciprocated. And that's definitely up for discussion. I would definitely be argued on that point, but I don't think it's reciprocal energy. So I think that's just something interesting that we experience. And I think a lot of Black women can attest to that, but I don't know if Black men can.
Mm. Josh, what do you think?
I think to Ayana's point, I've definitely heard the idea that, you know, Black women are kind of instilled with the idea of protecting Black men. From my experience, I obviously don't speak for every Black man. I don't think where I grew up, that was something that was, you know, where the inverse was true. You know, I wasn't getting the message of, you know, but protect Black women. I think as a man, I think, of course, the idea of being the man of the family, looking out for women around you, being the gentleman, like all of that stuff I heard about and everything. But from a racial perspective, from a Black male perspective, I can't say that was an idea that I heard a lot, which is sad because I think we should be protecting each other, to everybody's points. Again, I had the luxury of being a little bit, it was easier for me to make friends with women than it was with men. So over my 24 years of existence, I've been able to befriend a lot of Black women. And one thing I find valuable is, I guess, bucking the norm of what of their experience with Black men, because a lot of men in general can be pretty not good people, if you will. And so I really value the experience of just listening to somebody vent, to having an emotional connection, being a friend for them, being a brother to them, because that's what I enjoy anyway. But it's especially important to make sure that they feel validated and feel like they have somebody that they can go to and talk to. And it also helps that I'm not, again, the stereotypical male, Black male, however you want to characterize it, because I can do a lot of things. I can do more things as a friend with them than they might be used to. So I can go see Barbie with you if that's what you want. And it, to me, it doesn't cloud how I perceive myself. You know, if you want to go to a concert, you know, if you want to listen to some female artists, we can do it. So I think I'm in a very privileged space because of my, you know, how I grew up. But I don't think that's the norm, unfortunately.
The idea of Black men needing to be protected is largely, I think, due to mass incarceration and a lot of Black men getting unfairly prosecuted for crimes. And, you know, when we look at what that creates, part of what it creates is single parent households in the Black community and a lot of Black mothers who over time took on the really, really just odious mantle of welfare queens. I wonder why we never got to the point where we looked at Black women who were raising families by themselves and understood the need to have them be protected too. Because you would think that both groups are kind of in a vulnerable position as a result of systemic issues, right? But for some reason, we got there with men and we didn't get there with women. And I'm curious about why that is, but also if you all think that that's changing.
So I think people have this perception that like Black women are harder, like we have a harder shell. We don't wield as much love, protection, affection, and things like that because there are so many tropes of us being like aggressive, angry, like masculine. And so I think people don't think that you need it in the same way that they might think someone of a different race that was a woman would. And so they don't give it to us because they're like, oh, they're fine. Like, they can hold you down. Like, they just expect you to be kind. And for generations, women have done it. They've been kind. You know, like, they just keep on keeping on. And that's just kind of what the expectation is. I would say I still think with the generations that are coming that they feel the need to protect Black men. I have seen an overwhelming number of women on social media talking about how they would take charges for them. I think that's absurd, but I see it all the time.
I think we are taught from a very, very young age, Black women, that it's just something that we have to do, like we're supposed to do. And it doesn't matter if we have to do it by ourselves. It's just like a given that we're supposed to take care of our families, even if we don't have any help, or that's just like our main role of responsibility. So for example, if you're the first, I know a lot of people who fall into this category can attest to this, if you're the first black born daughter in a family, you're just saddled with so much more responsibility than maybe your older brother that's the only boy in the family, but he's your older brother or the immediately younger brother. And I know that's for a fact that they're saddled with more responsibility because I have an older sister and I really felt for her growing up because she just had to take on a lot more than I think was really fair. But part of it is that your parents really want to prepare you for what's out there in the world. And so I know that it's not personal, but it's definitely cultural. Like, it's something that a lot of Black girls go through growing up, having to take care of their families in a higher degree than it really should be when you're so young. And so with what Ayana's saying, as far as the idea is that Black women are just stronger and harder, so they should have to go through these things. They also think that it's like a responsibility for you. Like, you're meant to do it anyway, so just do it.
To your point about if protect Black men and should we protect Black women, is that an idea being perpetuated? I think the Meg Thee Stallion situation with Tory Lanez is a good reflection that at least in the zeitgeist, a lot of people don't really share the idea of protect Black women. Because even when the story first broke, a lot of people were making jokes about it. They were, you know, laughing at, you know, her feet being shot at. They didn't believe her. And even after the trial and everything, a lot of people are still like making fun of the situation. A lot of people are still like, Tory Lanez, he doesn't deserve what he got. I still don't even think that he does it. He did it. Like, why was she even in the situation?
So to give some context to people who aren't familiar, Josh, so the situation you're talking about with Meg Thee Stallion and Tory Lanez is a situation where she was allegedly shot in the foot by him, and the public reaction to that was to make jokes.
Sorry, yeah, perfect context. I apologize. But exactly. And again, Black Twitter makes fun of everything. So a level of that, it shouldn't be expected, but it's to be expected. But a lot of Black Twitter made fun of the situation. And so I just hesitate to believe, based on my experience growing up, based on what I see on social media, that the protect Black men energy is being reciprocated.
I always think about like the medical field and how Black women are treated, how we're like always assumed to be exaggerating about like pain and we need medication, and like everyone assumes that we have more strength than we do have. And so I think that even in like an attempt to protect us, it'd probably be minimal because you're already assuming that like we have certain strengths that would protect us in ways that, you know what I mean? Like, so I don't think that would be very easy to determine how to do that or define it in practice.
I think protecting Black women, part of it too, is just believing us when we say we're affected by something or that something's happening to us. I think a lot of the time we try to jump through hoops, kind of like what Ayana is saying, to disprove what a Black woman is saying, either because maybe we think she's exaggerating or the facts don't add up, or just there's always like, and it goes back to what Josh said thing too about Meg Thee Stallion, like, we need more facts before we always said we need more facts before we believe a Black woman. And I realize that I'm famous too, kind of, while the Carly Russell story is in the news about, you know, for context, Carly Russell, there was a massive hoax, and she said that she was kidnapped, and or she said that she saw a baby on the side of the road while she was driving, called 911, and it turned into this big, huge story to find her because she had disappeared. He came back home fine, and it was revealed by the authorities that it was a hoax. And I see a lot of people now saying, you know, it's going to make it 10 times harder to believe Black women now because of this huge story with Carly. And it just goes to show you can't believe anybody like up front just based on what they tell you because it's so suspicious. But I still feel like instances like that shouldn't prevent us or hold us back from being able to believe Black women when they do come forward about things, because these instances with like Carly Russell's and things like that, they're such a small subset of what really goes on in our lives on a day-to-day, which is on a much more massive scale. And so many more people aren't even talking about those stories to begin with, or let alone believing them. So when we think of like the Carly Russell's as representative of the entire bunch of the experiences of Black women, that does a disservice to Black women, and it just kind of takes away with what we try to do when we say protect Black women. That starts out by baseline believing us when we say things, and then, you know, of course, if it turns out to be false, then that's just an outlier. It's unfortunate that it happened, but that shouldn't affect how we talk about Black women's stories or consider how to help them on a broader scale.
How do we take care of each other? What do you all do within your circle of friends who are Black men, Black women? How do you take care of the people around you?
This is going to be my motto all year, but this is something that I actually want to do better at as opposed to what I currently do. Now, you all have heard this and you'll continue to hear this. We need to actually understand and get to know each other. I think that what I'm learning about law school, and I hate to accept this reality, is that we're all a bunch of work friends for the most part. Just happened to me in school. And I hate the idea of a work friend, like of a school friend, because I love making friends, and I hate to kind of undermine or invalidate a friendship by, you know, basing it within a space. But it's the reality of the situation, especially for law school. But within our community, I think we can, there is room for us to be much more than just school friends. But I hesitate to believe that that's not the reality at the moment. Like, we know enough about each other to where, you know, we can remember a birthday, you know where this person is working, where they're from, et cetera. But like, what actually makes a person tick? We don't do enough facilitating those type of conversations or creating those type of spaces where that is organically and comfortably shared. And so I think that's invaluable, whether it's male to male, whether it's Black male, you know, Black men and Black women. I just think we need to be better at creating those forums and creating those relationships where that's organic.
Law school also too, I think, is like an isolated activity. So if you're not intentional about making time for your friends or the things that you like to do, it's going to feel that much more intense, and you're probably going to struggle a little bit. Or you might, I don't know, you might do really well and end up on Law Review. But for a lot of people, for most people, relaxing, that involves community, and that involves having fun with your friends. So when you come to law school, as important as school is, you know, as important as that GPA is when it comes down to it, the last 2 weeks of the semester, it's also just as important to take care of yourself and just hang out with your friends and socialize. Even if you're not that social a person, I promise you're going to need it when you're in the law school life, because everything else is, like Ayana is saying, it just feels so intense. The stressors is probably something that you've never experienced before. So if you can mitigate that in any manner by joining like the movie club we have that Josh is a part of and Ayana, and I'm also, I think, a part of too, like just by finding things that you like to do and being intentional about reaching out to people in those clubs and just making connections. And it doesn't have to feel like work and can be as organic as like getting food or drinks with somebody after class. Like if you're intentional about that, law school, I think it's just going to feel a little bit lighter.
And one thing I tell prospective students, especially around this time where they're, or, you know, the beginning of fall semester is looming, is to identify what your hobbies are now so that, and feed into those hobbies now, because once you start, it's so easy to be consumed by everything law school related. And that's something I like to do, which is why I did start the movie group. I like to push back against the idea that we have to be 24/7 law students, because that's just not the case. You know, you can succeed, whatever success looks like for you, you can definitely achieve what you want and still also be a normal person. And I think that's a necessity sometimes, because if you just allow yourself to be stressed out, that's why we have all of the negative statistics out there regarding our profession. So again, I guess one thing I do make an effort to do is to remind people to do the things they enjoy, because I think if you ask your average law student what's their hobby, they will go, I don't know. I don't know what my hobby is. And to me, that's a little sad, because I know that if they were removed from a law school space, they would be more engaged in something.
It's important to remember that law happens in the context of life. It's what you do. It's not who you are. Ayana Murphy is president of the Notre Dame Black Law Students Association. Aisha Ba is social chair for the Black Law Students Association, and Joshua Mannery is president of the Notre Dame Student Bar Association. Ayana, Aisha, Josh, this has been a really fun, really insightful conversation. Thank you, all of you, for joining me on the DEI podcast.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
The DEI podcast at Notre Dame Law School is produced by Notre Dame Studios. Every episode, we sit down with important voices in law, culture, society, and business to talk about issues that touch all of us. If you liked what you heard today, become a subscriber and get notified every time we upload an episode. And tune in next time for another great conversation on issues that touch us all. Until then, take care.